Okay, tonight's class is called Organ Donation, Act of Kindness or Act of Murder.
So funny.
Kindness.
I was just going to ask you this question.
Well, we'll find out about it. We'll get into it. I know. As Samantha Grossman Tomlin, Rabbi, titles matter. No, you brought it. I asked. I remember you actually, you underscored that one time. I'm going to have my great Tinder title.
I got some people to join, though. You did get
that. That was it. Sex sells.
Okay,
so we're going to start off our class with a little, a quick review, like a brief review, and then we're going to transition, and then we're going to get into our, we got a double video situation, but I mean, of course, we're starting at 8:20, which is mucho late. Okay, so everybody'll get what you get.
Double video? I'm very excited. Thank you.
Yeah, double video. Everybody likes a double video, but it was not the night to have two video situations. All right, let's go. Okay, last week we talked about the Mon. We had a whole host of messages and ideas from the Mon. Who can share me a couple ideas?
I can tell you, but I wasn't here.
Okay, who? I want to listen. I'm going to focus upon people that were here and allegedly know something.
So it was all about the reason for the Mon Award. Some wanted to teach everyone appreciation and keep everyone on like an equal basis, and really give them that ability to prepare for future going into Israel. That they don't have to worry and struggle about food and conflict with others and jealousy over others and what they have.
Well, they're gonna. I mean, the Mon ended the when they entered into the land. Mm-hmm. It was not the Mon. The eternal Mon is not going with them.
Right.
But the lessons about that they all had to be happy with what they had or deal with the challenge of what they had. They had were only given an Omer's worth of Mon per day, and they prepared also for Shabbos. What is the idea of Shabbos? Then, or to gather the Mon for the 6 days, and the Mon, and then the Mon, the Shabbos Mon coming on Friday, so they didn't have to. Look for it. What did that teach them?
That you have to prepare for Shabbos before Shabbos, and you can't prepare stuff on Shabbos.
Well, that was the law. But what was it teaching them more of on a more broader basis?
Humility.
In what sense, humility? Okay. I mean, we're all in favor of the word. Let's hear for humility. Humility.
But
Rabbi. Oh, is somebody talking? Can't talk.
Yeah.
My hand's raised.
Okay. You didn't put your video on. I can't see you. So.
I can't. I don't know why it's not working.
All right, whatever. See, that's the benefit of people showing up in person. But whatever. All right, whatever. You get what you get. That's it. All right, we go to Dan Hackman.
I think it's that it's not all about creating. You have to stop creating at some point and show respect that there's a creator above us.
1,000%. In other words, the idea is that for 6 days we pursue our needs to support ourselves and our family. But ultimately, the fact that we have a Shabbos as part of the entire system, it shows that there is a higher goal. Really, Shabbos shows you the goal of life. That having a job, making a living is a means, it's not an end. There's a time for the rat race, and there's very time to get off the rat race. And the message of the Shabbos was pointing out that I work in Hashem's world. I don't control Hashem's world. And the fact is that I humbly, going back to what Katie was saying, I humbly and with humility step down from being the creator and recognize that Hashem's world working without me. You know, I'm stopping and the world keeps on going. And that's it. Let me show a little video because we go to our first video of the night.
Love this show.
Yeah, I do like the show also. I do. So you get into these shows, whatever. We're not talking about that. All right, I'm gonna prep it. So this is the prophet. It's on CNS. Thank you. All those letters. And basically, the guy Marcus Lemonis, he basically goes into small failing companies, and he helps them with their issues, which are oftentimes psychological. The people aren't getting along. There's some sort of issues either in their. He likes to say the three things: among the people, the process of the business, and of course the product itself. Okay, so let's read this. So this one is a called Athens Motors. Okay, what I want you to look about is the protagonist here is Pete, the owner of Athens Motors. Here we go.
10 miles outside of my hometown, Chicago.
Get the lights, please.
In Whartonville, Illinois. This is the home of Athens Motors.
In 2009,
Pete Athens, a car enthusiast and successful real estate investor who made millions flipping houses, sunk his entire life savings into building his first car dealership.
I created a place where you want to hang out, buy a car, sell your car, car's worth 30 all day, wholesale, service your car, or just come by and have a cup of coffee.
The project took 18 months and cost more than $4 million to complete.
I spent all my cash building this place and trying to keep it open. Come on. $1,500 one month, and it's hard to get more money to buy vehicles. We're scarce on cars.
Wow. He hired his cousin Tony to be general manager.
Hey, Mike, make sure you check that all the tires match.
I'm here every day to make sure everything is perfect.
And working together has strained their relationship.
Tony, come to my office, please.
And Tony has been talking about leaving Athens.
I can't work in an environment where the owner questions every single thing you do.
By repeating myself 3 times, you didn't fix the problem.
With no cars on the lot and no process in place, Athens Motors has been losing over $1.8 million a year. If help doesn't arrive within days, Athens Motors will be forced to close its doors forever, and Pete will lose his entire life savings.
If I close this place down, it would be catastrophic. So I hurt myself.
I just arrived at Athens Motors, and I can't figure out if this place is even open. Where are all the cars? But what they do have is all super high-end. In a good used car dealership, you have to have affordable cars. They're not even close to what the market really calls for. They could be $30,000 over per car what they actually should be carrying. Wow. Look at this. So the first time I noticed in the showrooms, I feel like I've just entered Caesar's Palace. There are no customers in there, much like the lot outside. The only thing I see are a few vintage luxury vehicles in the showroom. Hey there, Marcus.
Larry.
Nice to meet you, Larry. Is this car for sale?
Yes, it is.
How many miles on this?
2,400. Oh. It was restored.
Uh-huh. How many total cars on the lot?
Probably 20.
Total?
Total.
20 cars? 20 cars is more like a private collection than a used car dealership. A successful used car dealership is one that is built on having something for everyone. You have to have a wide array of price points and a wide array of selection. Is Pete here?
Yeah, he's in his office. I'll take you.
Okay. Pete.
Marcus,
how you doing, buddy?
Pleasure. Thank you for taking the time.
Absolutely.
What do you think of the place when you first walked in?
That's for sure.
This is my soul. I designed, I architect.
Have you been in the car business a long time?
No, I was only 5 years in the car business before I opened. I put everything I have in here in my soul and my bank account. Can I give you a tour of the place?
All right, let's do it.
I'm the one who did everything, so I'm ready to be one of the best independent stores in the United States.
Yeah, I guess the cars first. What did you spend on these walls?
Close to $100,000.
Okay.
Something right once, so I have to touch it ever again.
You put in how much in renovating the place? $1 million?
Over $2 million.
Wow.
The ceiling alone probably was about $15,000.
So one used car.
Correct. I created a state-of-the-art customer lounge.
And what did it cost to build out this whole room?
Close to $500,000.
Come on. So like that grand, how much does that cost?
Sounds are about $25,000 to $4,000.
And all this movie stuff, how much is that?
TVs are about $15,000. The seats are $25,000,
$30,000. Pete, what? How does any of this help you sell cars?
All right.
I made this store to be the place where you want to hang out, to have the best customer experience anywhere in the United States.
Okay.
I'm going to have to watch the rest
of it. Okay. Yeah. I feel like that. Okay. Okay, so let's just try to work on the obvious here. What lessons about success in Hashem's creation is Pete not understanding?
He had success.
Yeah. He had success in the real estate business.
Yeah. And then he blew it on a hobby.
Okay. What's the problem before Marcus Lemoyne gives his analysis?
Is greed? Like McDonald's guy.
Is he greedy?
I think he's more selfish.
Yeah. It's, what do you mean by selfish? Right.
He built what he would like and enjoy to hang out with without thinking that it was any type of business. That he would make any money off of it. It was more, I have some money, I'm going to spend it. This is where I would like to hang out at a place like this. So people will hang out, but people don't spend money if they just hang
out. Do people go to, when you go buy a car or a used car, do you want to spend 1 minute more than you need to buy the car?
No.
You want to hang out with this fat dude who's in a $2 million area?
Is there a mechanic that they have to service their car?
They do have that. That's actually holding the whole business together. They actually are. So basically what they don't.
Like the waiting room that I have to wait in when I get my car. Correct. Service. Yeah, that'd be cool.
Right. But you don't need to have, $15,000 painted ceilings and gorgeous Italian marble.
No, or, Regatina kind of has that thing going on.
But what do they have what she doesn't have?
But Regatina also has a high-end line of brand new cars where they can afford to have that.
Right. If you have used cars, what do you need? First of all, what do you need to have?
Cars.
Okay. So if you want to sell cars, you need to actually have cars. Okay. So this guy has it. He's a car buff. He wants to. He wants people to join him in the satisfaction of the high-end car experience. The bottom line is he's 10 miles out of Chicago. People need regular middle-class cars. They need regular cars. They need a Honda, a Toyota, a Ford, a this, a that. And this dude is like, he's got these gorgeous, he's got 20 cars, which are gorgeous. They're all $100,000 a piece. And how come there's nobody coming in here? And they don't have any money to buy cars.
He didn't think about his demographic.
Right. So here's the point. When we say about how, when we talk about success in Hashem's world, when Hashem created the world in a certain way, where there's certain bracha woven in, you have to work in his world, not what you fantasize it should be. The reason why his business is failing, because he wants to live in his world, in Pete's world, where people come and have a cappuccino and sit on a $50,000 couch and look at a $100,000 car and consider buying it. He's in a universe that doesn't actually exist, and therefore his business is about to fail. Okay, that's it. Now, in what way would Shabbos observance help Pete's understanding of opportunity? As the prophet says, you shall do work during the six work days and do all your tasks, but on Saturday is the Shabbos to God your Lord. Do not do anything that constitutes work. How would Shabbos help him understand what opportunity is?
Maybe it would sort of give him perspective that he could look forward to Shabbat instead of putting so much all his eggs into trying to enjoy his showroom.
Right, he's right. In other words, Shabbos what Jonathan is pointing out is that Shabbos by definition grounds a person, because basically, what a person like Pete and so many others can get lost in is this sort of fantasy of they're a great business titan or whatever fantasy they're living under. And therefore they have to obsess about it 24/7 and it's all they can do. Shabbos forces a person says, no, there's a time for pursuing your opportunity. And then there's time for looking at the big picture. And it ain't 24/7. You're not the creator of the universe. And whatever you're going to do, it might be important, but he's lost in his own creation, which is, and since it's just so removed from reality, that's why he's so wildly unsuccessful, because he's not working in the opportunity that's intrinsic in Hashem's world. We get to see opportunity in Hashem's world, not create opportunity in our mind, fantasize, well, then everybody's going to come because I thought about it. Hello. No, it doesn't work that way. Question, we go to Katie.
Another question, comment. There was an article a few months ago about the CEO of WeWork.
Yes.
Who, did you guys read it?
I did read it.
About how he started observing Shabbat, and he single-handedly, who knows if single-handedly, but he really says because he observed Shabbat, exactly what you were saying, grounded him, that's why his business is so successful.
Correct. In other words, he, if you guys Google the article, it's very interesting. Part of it, again, it puts you into perspective and therefore makes you see the world in a much more realistic manner. You're not trying to live in your head in the grandiose. You're not living in the penthouse of your grandiose fantasy building, which doesn't exist. It's helping you to see a bigger context and give context of meaning for your life. That would help Pete. So Marcus Lemonis is trying to, basically give him some clarity. And you can watch it on YouTube. I recommend it. It's a good watch. I'm tired. Okay, now, that's a perfect segue. We're going to get to the issue of organ donation. Obviously, Rabbi, I saw that coming. Okay. Little Pete. Okay. Call the prophet. Okay. What assumption about my body is underlying the word donation in the phrase organ donation? Think about that. What is implied about my body when I say the word organ donation? Yes. Wow, Aliza. Right? Okay, Aliza Kramer.
That you have any ownership of your body and the organs within it.
Right, in other words, this is my body, and I'm electing to make a donation of a kidney, let's say. Okay? In other words, the term organ donation means the body is yours, and you are deciding to take a part of it and give it as a donation. Correct? Is that implicit in the phrase?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Question? Comment? Yes.
Okay, so how come it's okay, reluctantly, to I think I know the answer, but how come that it's okay to donate an organ when you're alive to save a life, but it's not okay to donate an organ when you're dead?
By the time we walk out of here, we'll have the answer.
Oh, so let's go in the ground here.
Okay, well, no, we'll get, so we're going to, you're going to get some information. We'll answer that question. Okay.
Right, the same way as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Don't we have? Isn't there a separation between our neshama and our body?
That's called death. Yes.
No, but even in that.
What do you mean?
Even when we're living.
Well, your nefesh, your nefesh is not in your nefesh, which is not physical, is not within your skin. It relates to you.
No, but like, don't they? Isn't there an argument that maybe you don't even have your full, a full soul within you, and that
you're leaving me hanging here. All right.
Yeah.
You're a full soul.
No, just like this idea that because there's only a finite amount of souls.
Okay.
All right,
so you're talking. Okay. So you're talking. Okay. According to this is a great debate. Within the Kabbalistic school of thought, initially spoken about at length by the Ramban, Nachmanides, there's a Olam HaNeshamot. There's a reference in the Talmud as well. There's a finite amount of souls, and as such, that allows the possibility of reincarnation.
Right.
So that's a debate. There's certain people that maintain that reincarnation is not a Jewish concept at all. That's one school of thought. And one school of thought says that, yes, Judaism accepts reincarnation.
I just read.
And therefore, all right, so that's a whole mega topic.
But to tie into this, that there is, that we aren't, that we don't have ownership of our souls, so then why can't we have more, is it separate from our body, but maybe it's not separate?
All right, so hold on to that. I think we're going to answer your question. If not, you'll ask it again. Okay. All right, so the first source we're going to have Samantha Reed. Source number one, ethics of a father, otherwise known as in Hebrew is?
You
guys are geniuses. Go on.
Against your will, you are formed. Against your will, you are born. Against your will, you live. Against your will, you die.
Okay. Okay, we should put this on a t-shirt and this uplifting message from Pirkei Avot. So basically, but what is art? Right, okay, what is basically is the, what is, what, okay, it's a harsh phrase. Against your will, you are formed. No, against your will, you are born. Against your will, you live. And against your will, you die. What is this statement from Pirkei Avot basically essentially saying?
Everything comes from Hashem.
But more specific, that's true.
Your life is from Hashem.
Or in other words, you don't get a choice in the matter. You don't get a choice to be born. You don't get a choice to live. And you don't get a choice of when to die. We're gonna expand upon it. In other words, our existence is not that nobody said I'd like to be born. No. Your parents got together and had you. Okay, did I say that in an elegant manner?
Absolutely.
Thank you. All right. And as such, and they did not. There was no you there to consult. You showed up together with Hashem, and that's it. You were thrust into the world, and now you're living. And then, how long we're going to live, we do not know. We have a measure of control. We can frustrate that. And then one day we're not going to be here. Okay. So it's really not. That really shows the idea that, from a Jewish perspective, our existence is not essentially fully ours. So what is really our relationship with our? What is really our relationship with our body? Really, the question. Okay. So we say, going back to Elise's point? Let's say if the soul is really you, what is the soul's responsibility to your body?
Souls or something?
No, the that which is the you, okay?
I think the soul isn't you.
Mm-hmm. Why is the soul not you?
That the soul is part of, more a part of Hashem, mm-hmm. because it's part of...
Well, you can't say...
Is it part of Hashem in you? No, it's a part of Hashem. Because mm-hmm. I believe in the finite amount that it's part of everything else that came before.
Okay, so we got to be a little bit careful in our... You might say that your soul reflects godliness, but it's not a part of God. We do say the phrase, Shema Yisrael, Hashem, Hashem Echad. So if he's one, he ate 8 billion. Yeah. Okay, do you understand that? And the body and the soul is created. It might have a godliness to it. You know, the difference between it being a part of God or godliness. And that's a very important distinction. What we're saying is because Hashem is one.
But then
if you're saying he has parts, or if he hacked off a part of him and put it in a body, then you're saying there's a problem with God's unity.
But aren't people all supposed to be one?
We're all
connected.
Well, we might have we're all part of the brotherhood of mankind in a certain sense. We're all created beings.
Rabbi David Aaron was here and he gave
the whole album. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Different instruments and all are one.
And the ocean,
oh,
and
remember
all
that.
What is that?
Okay, so I can't comment on I don't know what I wasn't in that class.
Rocks in the ocean.
Okay, so again that. Okay.
Yeah. I remember
that
I had to be like Rabbi Aaron said.
Yeah.
Okay, so I wasn't there for the drops in the ocean, but just let me just take more of a. Instead of going to a more sophisticated or Kabbalistic perspective, which is oftentimes uses a lot of metaphor and it's hard to really pin down exactly, the basic idea is that God is one. We say that in Shema, it's pretty clear cut, and therefore He can't be dividing Himself. He can't have component parts because I think that's another religion we call it Christianity with the Trinity. So if you're expanding the Trinity into 8 billion, you got a little problem there. God, in other words, yes, when we say God is one, He's uniquely one. His oneness is like a one. That nothing else is. Every body is composed of parts. It does not have any parts. Therefore, in sharing, you got nothing to share. He can endow. He, in other words, we say in the morning, "Elokai Nishma," God, "Elokai Nishma," the soul that you created, Tahuri Atavata, you created. If He created it, He's not taking it from Himself. You know what I'm saying? It could have a godly quality. It could be completely differentiated. It could have a divine-like aspect to it, but it's not part of the divine. I'm just saying on the plain thing.
Like
otherwise, that. You just didn't want, then just dive into yourself because you're God. You know what I'm saying? I'm just sharing. I'm not now again. I'm just explaining a basic understanding. I'm not saying it's the only understanding, but does that follow? Is that what we're trying to give you is a basic logical idea. Are these complicated areas? Yes. Could it be multiple levels of meaning to this? Yes. But again, you have to deal with certain problems. We know that a foundational principle of Judaism is Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. You have to deal with God's unity. Okay. So I'm just, I don't want to get into that. That's not really the topic. But just going back to really, our focus is not the soul too much today, but really is the body. Assuming that your soul is not recycled, okay, assuming that you have your own original soul, let's just go with the basic idea that you have your own soul, the Lisa soul, in a certain sense, that's really you. That's really your essence, okay? So you basically are responsible for your body. But in a certain sense, it's not yours. Hashem created it, and we have responsibility to maintain it, but we have to feed it, take care of it, live a healthy existence. But we can't do whatever we want to it. The biggest example, what is a prohibition of Judaism? Suicide is a key point. That's the excellent. In other words, it's a prohibition, even articulated by Noah, that you're not allowed to take your life. Now, why can't it? If I own myself, why not? The answer is you don't own yourself. That's what he says. That's what Pirkei Avos says. Against your will formed, against your will you were born, against your will you live, against your will you die. It's not our right to do that. We can't just kill ourselves. Okay? Just going to stop right there. Is that clear? I'm just saying that if you start with this premise, does that result make sense to you? Okay, so all right, we're late. I'm going to have to skip the second video. Okay.
That was good.
It is a very good one. Okay.
Come on.
Just type in my. Okay. One second. All right. We'll say hello. I interviewed my wife.
Oh.
Hi, everyone. I asked my wife, Marie Beth, to participate in my class by the magic of Zoom. And tonight, we're just dealing with the issue of organ donation. And our first source that we're dealing with is from Pirkei Avot, Ethics of Our Father. Pirkei Avot says the dramatic statement of against your will you are formed, against your will you are born, against your will you live, and against your will you die. What is being conveyed there, as we discussed, is the idea that we live in a Hashem's world. And all the processes from the laws of nature, gravity, a respiratory system, all the different experiences of our life, really we are actors within. We do not have sovereignty over the system. One of the most beautiful experiences that really brings us to bear in a very vivid way, in sort of undeniable way, is the miracle of pregnancy and childbirth. So my wife is an expert, and she had not one but six children. And I wanted to take on the matter of pregnancy and childhood and childbirth is evocative of the idea of manifesting for Hashem's control over the whole process. Redison Marie Bavakasha.
First of all, I'm very honored that you're curious what my thoughts are on this topic, and thank you for asking. I was wondering when you were going to ask me this question.
I was just kidding.
So so your specific question is, please restate the question.
What experience within pregnancy and childbirth makes it clear to you as a mother or all mothers the sense that you're part of a system beyond yourself, you're part of Hashem's creation, or as Mara said, you're a partner with Hashem. What moment did your experience really dramatize that dramatically? Mm-hmm. The experience that I've not had.
Okay. experience of being pregnant or a woman is really a life-changing experience. And part of that is because of the feeling of not being in control. And a lot of our life, we make plans and we execute plans and we make lists and we accomplish some of the things on our list. But when a person is pregnant, their body has its own list and their body has its own time schedule. And that might not coordinate with your list or your schedule or anything else. And for the first time in a person's life, it's very clear that you're not in control even of your own body. Because we know that we're not in control of things outside of our body. The subway may be late. The weather might be different. We might have been stuck in traffic. There are lots of things that affect our life that show us we're not in control of exactly what's going on in our day. But until a person really, I think, experiences pregnancy, it's a very, very tangible feeling that even within your own body, you're not in control. And the fact that something is going on that you did not consciously do or plan for or schedule is an amazing miracle. It has to cause someone to pause and to think.
That's an excellent answer. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for joining our senior fellowship class. And we'll do this again. All right.
Okay. If you have follow-up questions, then take those questions for next time.
Got it.
All right. Yeah. All right. There you have it. Okay.
We should have Mary Beth come in as a guest speaker.
She could. That should be excellent. All right. We have it there. I'm going to tell her that she's got time. All right. All right. So let's, so denying the reality of my body as an independent natural system is the cause of all unhealthy living. I fantasize I can do what I want rather than seek being in harmony with natural processes. Give me some examples of that.
Eating whatever you want.
There you go. Number one on the board. Bing! In other words, if a person like gorged themselves with food, they're believing them, they believe at that moment they can eat whatever they want and will have no consequence because their body, of course, is not operating as an independent natural system. And then, typically 20 minutes later, the body says, you know what you thought? You're wrong. And you're going to need some medical help to cure this problem here. What other example of being forced to recognize that my body is a independent natural system?
Well, you can't choose to go to the bathroom whenever you want.
Correct. Right. If they say nature calls, you need to be answering. What else?
Right. People who work.
Exercise?
Okay, fine, go on, hold on, but Jonathan?
People who work the night shift, they say they never quite get on a real schedule because your body is in line with when it's dark and when it's light, and
right.
It just is.
Right, you can't force, if there's a natural sleep cycle, there's a limit to what you can manipulate that because it's operating in its own system. This is all showing the fact that your body, in a certain sense, is more part of Hashem's world than I imagined it. I want to be able to eat and drink and smoke and do whatever I want to the extent that I want, there'll be no consequences. And then Hashem's world says, hello, this is not reality. Okay. That's fine. You wanted to add a point to that?
No, I was just going to say, like the self-care, like getting enough sleep at night and eating, exercising, it goes along with eating also, right? All those
right. In other words, and the reverse is, since if I do recognize that my body has an independent natural system, I start thinking out, well, how can I nourish this body? How much does this body need proper sleep? When am I the most creative? Let me do my creative during that time. When am I like kind of hit that afternoon lull? Maybe I'll do my more busy work. You know what I'm saying? If you start to become more in harmony with your body, you and your body will be happier and more successful. Okay, the pasuk that really brings that is the source number two. So let's have Gail.
The earth is the Lord and everything in it, the world and all who live in it.
Okay, so basically we say in Tehillim that basically everything in Hashem's world belongs to him. And therefore, we belong to him. And therefore, he's the owner. We can't do whatever we want. So that goes back to the issue, that's part of the issue of tattoos. Hashem, part of the prohibition of the Torah is for tattoos, now for whatever reason why. But therefore, I'm not allowed to cut myself or injure myself unnecessarily, you know what I'm saying, for no medical purpose. You know, the issue comes up in debate about cosmetic surgery. Am I allowed to just do whatever I want because I want to for alleged better beauty? You know, sometimes yes, sometimes no. Okay, there's an issue about that. Okay, then we get to Jonathan. Source number three. Let's keep on rocking.
Like I said, my father is 114. Hillel says, if I am not for myself, who will be for me? But if I am only for myself, who am I? If not now, when?
It's a classic statement. Mm-hmm. So what is this? If I'm not for myself, who will be for me? What does that really mean?
If I don't take care of myself, who will take care of myself?
Right. That brings out, Hill says that every person has a responsibility to take care of themselves physically, emotionally, and spiritually. You are responsible first and foremost for yourself.
But
then there's the counterpoint. What's the counterpoint? But if I'm only for myself, who am I? What's the counterpoint to that statement?
That if you're only for yourself, then you really don't have a purpose to live, because then, we say it every morning, the ability to, pass on Torah to your children and your grandchildren, and so, to take this,
Right. If I am 100% correct, if I view myself as being the totality of the world, that's also a falsehood. So therefore, I have to know that I live. I have to be concerned about myself and my family and my community and the world. If I'm only self-absorbed, that's also a distortion. So I have to be concerned about first myself, chayecha kodem, your life first. But then number two, I have responsibility for family, friends, community, and society and the world. Okay? And then, of course, the third, and if not now, when? You know, if something's a priority, don't push it off. Okay, now we get into them. We're going to shift gears to sort of the halachic issues with the issue of organ donation. Okay, all right, Dan Hackman, source number four. Let's keep on going. We're on a tight time clock here.
Okay, fine. A man is legally sentenced to death and executed. He must then hang him on the gallows.
Go on.
However, you may not allow his body to remain on the gallows overnight, but you must bury it on the same day. Since the person who has been hanged is a curse to God, you must not let it defile the land that God, your Lord, is giving you as a heritage.
Okay, so this is interesting. So what is that halacha telling us?
Technically, we were all created in God's image. So this idea of that if you're hanging, we're all God's creation. So if you're hanging the body, then you're desecrating God's creation.
Okay, so you see there's an idea here where they call, the Hebrew would call nivul hamet, degrading or desecrating the body. Or the positive, there's an obligation called kavod hamet. So in general, when somebody passes away, this case in the Torah, we're talking about a person who's a criminal, person who was... who is getting executed by the court. Even him, what do you have to do? Do you let him swing in the wind? No. After he dies, you got to take his body down and you have to bury him immediately.
Well, after the Six-Day War, the Israeli soldiers did that, even though they weren't Jewish. The Jordanian, didn't they do it? There was an article recently written about the Battle of Ammunition that they buried their enemy.
Okay. Okay. I don't know that story specifically, but they could 100% be true. I just don't know. But just here's the basic halacha. This is something you need to know because everybody's going to experience it at some point or another. In general, when a person passes away, there's a mitzvah to bury them as soon as possible. The only thing is, so kavod hamet. You don't let the body sit in state. I don't know. When I was a principal, we'd have non-Jewish teachers. I would go to wakes all the time. And they'd have the open casket thing and they'd be hanging out there for a couple days. They didn't have that idea, okay? So we have the idea of burying as soon as possible. The only time you delay it is if you have significant relatives are coming from out of town and therefore it's greater honor that they're going to, that when they get buried, their funeral will be attended by their loved ones. So they'll delay it like a day or so. for people to fly in. The same one in general. Let's say a person passes away, they try to do same day, and but if people are coming from out of town, they'll wait a day to be there at the burial. Yes. Well, sometimes, again, since we live in America and there's
like
a right
or Shabbat,
correct, so, correct, correct, right, correct, correct. We don't 100%. We do not bury on Shabbat. We do not bury on Yom Tov. We do not bury on Yom Tov. Okay. We do not. Okay. So
if somebody passes away and by themselves in their home, and their police have to do an investigation, it can be delayed because
okay.
The police investigation.
Okay. So again, so correct. So we're gonna hold on to the idea. Okay. So I'm just gonna. So source 5 basically tells us there's a prohibition to leave. There's a Torah prohibition of do not let his corpse tarry overnight. Okay. So there's a negative commandment. Let's go to Halacha 8. I'm just trying to economize our time here because we're already hit 9 o'clock. Okay. So Kei Bavakasha, Halacha 8.
Sure. It is a positive next to bury the person executed by the court on the day of their execution. It is a state for you shall surely bury him on that day. But only those executed by the court, but anyone who needs to deceased overnight without burying him transgresses a negative commandment. If, however, a burial is believed overnight to honor the deceased, for example, to bring a coffin or shrewd, there is no transgression.
Okay, so if your delay is to for greater honor, and you get a coffin or shrouds, whatever the deal is, relatives, it's fine. So there's a prohibition to unnecessarily do that. Now, part of the lack of the thing called a nivula make, which is, let's say, cutting out the body. So as what Jay pointed out, in Judaism, for idle curiosity, we don't do an autopsy. Okay, we don't defile, we don't deface the body. Okay. A major issue is the greatest defamation of the body, of course, is cremation. Many Jews who don't know are getting cremated. That's a very major prohibition in Judaism, not to get your body. And I've had MG fellows, like relatives, were going to get cremated. So to help, I was providing guidance to the fellow to talk to the rest of the family to try to advocate a traditional Jewish thing. It's a very common thing now.
What do you do if the person puts it in their will?
What?
What do they do if the person puts it in their will?
Again, in America, we know. Again, you can't. There's very limited. If again, you can only do what you can do. If a person, if the executor of the estate is somebody who is not observant and has no priority, and it's not gonna listen, you do what you can do, and that's it. It's tragic. But interesting, halacha is if a person is cremated, in general, you don't sit shiva for them. It's viewed as an act of wickedness because they're blowing off a Jewish Jewish proper burial. Okay, I'm just giving you a sense of how significant it is. So, what one thing that you can no shiva nothing. So one thing is to say, hey, look, I know that this is not important to you, but it would make the family happy, or at least part of the family happy, if we can honor you in the traditional way that we've been doing this for the last 4,000 years. It's not about, I understand that you don't want it, it's not important to you, but it would make us very happy. You know, we'd be able to honor you in the way of our forefathers for the last 4,000 years. You know, would you consider that? It would make it, because otherwise it'll create greater harmony in the family when you're gone. And even though that, you know, many times people are an atheist, doesn't believe in this, so you have to, you know, to use the argument of family unity, and, you know, we want to be able to come together after you're gone. I'm just saying these are strategies you have to talk about when you have relatives who just simply don't know and or don't care or actually are against. All right.
I have a question. What if the body is so defiled that you can't get it? Like, the
fine. Right. So this happens all the time. In other words, you bury whatever part you have left. Yeah, it's a burial. As long as it's got to be... there are small, you know, the question is what's the minimum quantity, like a gazayat, of flesh?
Wow.
Okay, this is really an issue. It very happens often, you know, in the Israeli army, you know, in 1973, you had fierce tank battles, and you had guys that got blown up in a tank, so you can imagine what's left over. Not a whole lot. Okay, so these are terrible shilohs. But I want to quickly segue. I want to at least deliver on what I promised. Let's read Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, two valid halachic positions about brain death. All right, let me have, who would like to read? Volunteers, quick, Anna.
Wherever we can save life, we should. That is a fundamental proposition of Judaism, and it means that we favor organ donation. At the heart of Judaism is the principle of the sanctity of life, which flows directly from the proposition in the first chapter of the Bible that we are all in the image and likeness of God. The secular counterpart is Kant's principle that we should treat others as ends in themselves, not as means to an end. This generates several moral consequences, two of which are honor life and save life. Usually these two principles coincide, but sometimes they conflict. There are two kinds of organ transplants that raise no ethical problems. There are organs, kidneys for example, that can be taken when the donor is alive and whose removal is not life-threatening. The donor can continue to live. We commend such donations. At the other extreme, there are additional organs that can be taken when the donor is clearly dead, for example, cornea. Here, too, we would fully support such a decision. There are, however, other cases that no one would countenance. The obvious case is taking the heart of someone who is still alive. We may not take one person's life to save the life of another. That is using someone as a means, not an end. What then of cases where there is reasonable disagreement as to whether a patient is alive or dead? This can happen when, for example, there is no brainstem activity, but the patient's heart continues to beat. Is brainstem death the only possible criterion of death? On this specific question, religious and medical authorities, both Jewish and otherwise, have disagreed, some accepting brainstem death as a criterion of death, others insisting that the only criterion is cessation of cardiac activity. Opinion on this one point remains divided. This is serious because of the gravity of the issues involved, honoring life and saving life. We may not sacrifice the one to fulfill the other. For those for whom brainstem death is not the criterion of death, we may not take a vital organ from a patient still alive.
Okay, so this is a very big issue. So do you need respiratory and brain death, or respiratory death? You know, the problem is that if you wait till the person's not, you know, complete respiratory death, the organs are no longer fresh and do not have any utility. The reason when a person has brainstem death, the rest of the body is completely functioning, you know, perfectly, and the organs are therefore fresh and can be truly helpful. So the debate in halakha. Now, if you hold, let's go through the possibilities. If you hold brainstem death is not death, what would happen? What would you be doing if you harvested an organ from that person? You'd be killing them. You'd be violating from the Ten Commandments, lo tirzach, thou shalt not murder. This is a heavy-duty question. Murder.
It is like a vegetable.
If the person is, if you're from the position that you need to have respiratory death, and the person has, you know, they're breathing either on their own or with a respirator, but they have brainstem death, right? And you basically, because you're killing them to take out their heart or their lungs or their whatever organ that you're taking.
What are the Jewish doctors doing?
So there's a debate in Israel. The general psak, unless you specify otherwise, they do accept brainstem death as death. The implication being like this: one of the rabbis in Israel, they have, there's a chief rabbi, and then every major city has their own chief rabbi. One of the chief rabbi of one of the towns named Rabbi Ratzon Arusi made the following suggestion to cause a firestorm in Israel. I'm going to say what he suggested. Goes back to the issue of organ donation. He says, since we are holding the position that brainstem death is death, every hospital should have an independent council to determine if there should be taking of organs. Why? Because if the person is truly dead, and I have a person next door that needs a liver, it's not a nice thing to do. You must take that liver out. And even if the parents don't want it, It's not an earth, since it's not your body, and it's not the family's body. So really, there should be an objective counsel that will determine this person has hit the threshold of halakhic death. I have in the hospital a person who needs a liver, who needs a kidney, who needs a heart. We're taking it. Okay? So that was an explosion in Israel. Okay? But I'm just saying, but from law, but then, again, if you take from the premise that your body is not your body, A, and if stem death isn't truly death, you take those two statements, then it's a chiyuv, it's an obligation to have that harvested. And the fact that the parents want the whole body is irrelevant. Other possibility, if you hold that really is not death, you need full respiratory death as well, then the person who's doing that is a murderer. Halachically, by the way, very important point, there's this, when a person right before death called a goses, you're in the last steps of life. You're not halachically allowed even to touch them, unless it's for therapeutic value. Why? Because if you touch the person who's on death's doorstep, you could be hastening the death, and you're a murderer also. Okay, so I'm just we're just walking into the.
You're also impure if you touch someone who died.
That's the least of the issue. They're not dead yet. They're not dead. No, they're not dead. No. So that's
what about from the other side? Are there people that turn down or
okay, so that gets, like, now we're getting into the halakhic. So if excellent semantic, fantastic question. Now we get the other side. So if you hold that brain death is not death and you need the liver and the non-Jewish person's family, they don't care. So you're saying, I'll take the liver. You're basically agreeing to an assassination so you can have a liver. Right? This is going on. Okay, so this is, okay, now we're getting to the, okay, all right, so hold on. So let me share you, okay. Let's put it all together here. Let me put it all with the main principle. We were talking about from the Man and Shabbos about living in Hashem's world. Part of Hashem's world is literally our body, which we have responsibility for, but we do not have ownership. And only that, there are prohibitions of that. When the body dies, we have obligation to treat it in a honorable fashion and bury it as soon as casual. We can't cut it open. If there was a true death and the person needed an organ that could be harvested, let's say corneas, then you'd have an obligation to give the guy the corner. In other words, that would override the pikuach nefesh. Helping a person in that situation would override keeping the body in a whole and intact fashion. Everybody follow me on that? I'm just doing a quick review. Now we get to the big debate, which has been there's a big divide among the halakhic decisors. Is respiratory death, and therefore that only comes after brain death? Or even brain death, only brain is a sufficient indicator for criteria for death. Now I get the big issue here. So in general, we do favor organ donations. The question is, if you're wrong about the death thing, you're involved in murder. So halakhically, this is an issue that is what they call above my pay grade. So therefore, we are in favor of organ donation. The question is when, and there's a divide. The state of Israel, the Rabbanut, has accepted the brain death criteria, and therefore many have advocated, alarmingly or surprisingly, says it's not. It becomes not a personal issue because your body's not yours. You now have an opportunity to save another person in the hospital. You must do it. It's a chiyuv. So the Israeli society is not, since the Israeli society is not chosen all committed to halakha, they were not ready to agree that they still now in Israel. It's now still a decision of the family. Okay? But one of the rabbis says, you want to go all the way. It's not really a personal decision. It's an objective decision of a lot of it. In order, the body is not yours. It's Hashem. And you have opportunity to save somebody's life. You must do it. The fact that you have a hang-up, you don't want Uncle Sidney to be in the casket there without his liver, too bad. Grow up. You grew up in that fish. One of my friends, also a very wild friend, what was it? It was Erev Rosh Hashanah, that's got to be now 15 years ago, J.J. Greenberg. J.J. Greenberg was part of me in Schlock Rock. He went bicycling on Erev Rosh Hashanah, got hit by a car, and was brain dead. His family, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, famous rabbi, and up in Riverdale, Blue Greenberg, his mom, they decide to have like 8 of his organs donated. They maintain the brain death criteria, and his 8 of his organs are in 8 people now. Yeah.
So, has there ever been a situation where somebody is brain dead and they sparked back to
being no, terminal?
Okay.
So, all right. So, what I'm giving you is sort of a helicopter view, sort of a Baskin Robbins. I'm just giving you a little taste of the thing. There's an entire tub of literature. Okay. I'm just giving you a little kiss of knowledge. I'm giving you. But I'm not giving you the whole thing. So there's a lot of stuff on this. Now, Rabbi Walls and our friend named Robbie Berman. And he runs an organization called the Hebrew Organ Donation Society, HOES.org. Halachic Organ Donation Society. Halachic Organ Donation. He actually came and spoke at MG. Go onto the website. He has all the literature and the positions very elegantly mapped out. So if you want more information, just go onto the website. And of course, you can sign up and have a card and say, I agree to and then you can, get sort of a health proxy, and I can, for example, my parents, so I'm their health proxy. So I asked them, who is their halachic decisor who has more knowledge about Israel? So if, God forbid, my parents are elderly, if they're, it's going to be a medical crisis, and there's going to be an issue of DNR, that really needs halachic expert. Because you can't just, in America, the criteria of having people being taken off life support, food, and things, can be 100% murder, halachically. So what you can, parents, kids can be involved in literally murdering their parents, halachically. So you have to, when you get into a situation, you need to consult a halachic expert. Now, just like in law, you have people who are specialty in real estate and specialize in corporate mergers and acquisitions and securities. This is a halachic specialty. For example, for me, this is above my pay grade. I know who I would call. There are people that I would call who are experts in this area. I'm just not one of them. Okay, because you need to have what do you need to have? You need to have a massive knowledge of the medical information.
Yeah. So would you say that most of the rabbis probably have a medical degree?
Now, for example, with Moshe Feinstein, he just consulted with the doctors till he got the knowledge necessary, and he would make those decisions. But literally, they're life and death decisions. Because if you're wrong, it's not like, oh, I forgot to bench. Okay? You know what I'm saying? There's sometimes a halachic problem like, oh, I didn't bench. Or I said the wrong amidah. Okay, that's a halachic problem. Oh, I did the wrong thing on Shabbos. That's a halachic problem. Oops, I killed dad. That's a bigger halachic problem. Okay? So, you know what I'm saying? This is a big one. Okay? This is a big one. You know what I'm saying? So, I'm just saying, God forbid you're in a situation where if your parents or your close relatives are going to be in a significant medical crisis, you want to be able to have, in addition to your medical team providing the best care, to have a halachic specialist who is adept at this. And we at MG have, unfortunately, we have people that we have sent MG ears to when they've had the situation. Part of life. Okay, we're going to go to Dan the Man, and we're going to call him tonight.
All right, well, this is a pretty specific question. Let's say, I name my brother as my healthcare proxy,
Yes.
And then I put him there, because he's not religious at all.
Correct.
So if I put in my healthcare proxy that he needs to consult Rabbi Wild,
yeah,
I can do that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Excellent. Right, so in issues of life or death, or specifically DNR and all that stuff, must consult this rabbi, or a rabbi or a rabbi of his selecting. You know what I'm saying? Or a rabbi of, you know, who he, you know, he can deputize. Whereas the Rabbi Wiles is not available. All right. I hope I've at least sparked your interest. Yeah, the goal is spark your interest. Good. We'll take.
You know, very interesting. You know how you were saying in one class how the greatest thing you could do for somebody is somebody that can't give back?
All right, guys. Have a good Hi, Jenna.
Hi, Rabbi.
Good time. Bye, Shayna. Have a good night.
Good night, Rabbi.
Good night, Rabbi. Thank you.